take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good morning, I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. Today, I have a conversation with Samantha Hunt, an author whose third novel, Mr. Splitfoot, has just come out in hardcover. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We'll talk about the novel, we'll talk about motherhood, we'll talk about love, we'll talk about grammar, music, and her life as a writer and a mother. She is one of the most amazing people I've ever met. She is so generous, so kind, and so full of wonder that it's almost unbelievable. Of Mr. Splitfoot, it has been said that it is a subversive ghost story that is as haunting in its examination of family, motherhood, and love as it is in its conjuring of the otherworldly. It will set your heart racing, your imagination aflame. Unwinding in an ingenious structure, it tracks two women in two times as they march toward a mysterious, explosive reckoning. A contemporary gothic, it is a truly fantastic novel in which the blurring of natural and supernatural creates a stirring, visceral conclusion. And that is true, true, true. We'll have an interlude by Linda Thompson, and we will exit with Bill Fox. Enjoy.
I'm talking with Samantha Hunt, and we're stuck on grammar, and we're stuck on pronouns. Now that sort of gender fluidity is a thing, it makes you rethink your understanding of the world and people and your relationship to it and them. But so you're saying that you had, at the beginning of your classes now, you have to do the pronoun.
Mm-hmm. Which pronoun you prefer.
Which pronoun you prefer.
Yeah, and a lot of my students are going by they, them.
Mm-hmm.
They, them, and I'm, you know, support them 100% in exploring gender fluidity. But mm-hmm. It's really hard for me as someone who grew up maybe not having a perfect handle on grammar to now, like, subvert all the rules that I learned about the plural and the singular
together. So
it kills me.
So there's he, yeah. There's she.
Mm-hmm. And they, them. I actually have a student who identifies as we, us also.
He's a royalty?
Yeah.
Perhaps?
Oh, I see. I called him a he. I'm really bad at this. They, you know, we, us is a plurality, I guess, a plurality of personalities.
Well, the queen uses it.
Yeah.
Right? Yes,
yeah.
We are not amused.
Yeah.
Right?
I know. I mean, I love it. It really has expanded my thinking being with these students. It's amazing how to watch language changing the world, right? That's what happens when they're thinking about their pronouns and they're making language that's going to change their world and change how all of us think. And it's funny. I mean, it definitely trips my brain up a lot more than it does their younger brains.
Well, because
which
they're,
is cool.
Yeah. Well, because
which is really cool.
They haven't learned all the rules of grammar.
They
yet.
Haven't learned all the rules yet. Yeah. And
it doesn't give them comfort the way it does us.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's it. So very cool. Very cool to be part of that.
Yeah. But, I mean, do you think it's going to be like a permanent shift? I mean, do you think it's going to, or is this a fad or a phase? Or
I think it's probably going to be permanent.
You think it's going to be permanent?
I do,
you think
yeah.
You'll finally
settle
on a particular pronoun that is non-gendered?
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen. But I think that people are going to choose their pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
That will be something that's electable, you know? That you decide what your pronoun is rather than what the junk you were born with deciding it, right?
What do you think, where does this come from? Like, why this push?
Mm.
I mean, it's, to me, I mean, it when I first heard this, I thought, like, my initial thought was, who cares?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, but I'm a man.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So I have
yeah.
that, you know, I have that position
yeah.
of power and privilege,
the privilege. Mm-hmm.
To not care.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who cares? There is that. I mean, there is some idea of like, okay, if we're going to get to that point, it's like, doesn't every single individual in the world then require his or her or their own pronoun to be individual.
Right.
And something about that saddens me too, because I think, wow, that's ultimate alienation if we have no common ground, you know. But so I don't think we're going to go to, you know, that level of individuation. But maybe there is one pronoun that we can all agree on eventually.
And just use one just pronoun use one. Instead of he, she.
Then. Yeah. Like, yeah. It. It. We'll all be its.
Ooh. Ooh.
That'll be hard for me.
It rubs the lotion on its skin.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That will be hard. Yeah. It's not going to work for me. It's too much of an objectification. But.
But isn't it the ultimate in prescription? I mean,
yeah, and I really do identify as a she in a proud way. I don't want to lose. Yeah,
certainly your book, Mr. Splitfoot, is a strong female narrative. I mean, it is about motherhood.
Yeah.
Ironically, it's a book about motherhood without any mothers in it.
The power of the mother often happens in the absence of the mother, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's where we notice it the most.
And there are surrogate mothers, certainly. Mm-hmm. There are people filling the mother roles. There are people filling the roles of sisters that are not classically sisters.
Yeah.
Does it obscure then the conversation, or just like pretend it doesn't exist, or that the differences don't exist? And is that sort of self-delusion or self-deception?
I mean, for me, the aspect of mothering is essential to the book, essential to my life. I mean, the whole book came out of that. I had a 2-year-old when I started this, and I was pregnant with twins, like 8 months pregnant with twins, which is like 16 months pregnant, right? It's funny to say that because I know it's a really creepy book and it's a really dark book, and so...
Oh, is it? I found it.
Oh, yeah! Kevin Factor likes it, i.e. it's really not...
I laugh right.
That's funny. I mean, there's some humor there, too.
No, there is humor. There's some... It's sneaky.
Yeah.
It's sneaky. It's sneaky humor, and it's on a very...
But that was part of my point. It was like, you know, let's also... I think that I was so surprised by motherhood that, you know, all the cliches that you hear about it growing up are some sort of, you know, a sense of total comfort and cliches galore, you know, and... Even some sense of like ease or natural, you know, that it's natural to be a mother, natural to be a good mother.
Right, it's natural. Panic is natural.
Yeah.
Feelings of inadequacy are natural.
I know, all of that. So when all of that starts to creep
natural
in.
Natural isn't always good.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I had no idea. And I thought, wow, why doesn't anyone prepare us for just... And I don't mean to say, like, how horrible it is, because that's not my experience of mothering at all.
Mm.
I love it.
Mm.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
Mm.
But my experience is also that it's the most intense thing in the world. It's like somebody put me in a spaceship, shot me up to outer space, and I toured around, and I've come back to Earth with this knowledge. And quite frankly, that's, like, the respect I want all mothers to have. They're brave explorers going into this realm that's, oh my God, mind-blowing, you know? And I don't think that we treat mothers like that. Uh-huh. I mean, and so ultimately, a lot of the book for me was about the fact, like, mothers are the people who make life, yes, and that's happy and good, but mothers are also the people who make death. So why, you know, where is the loss in that? How come that authority is never... presented to young girls.
They make death just by virtue of their making life.
They're making a life, yeah.
That has an end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That has to end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty powerful. Yeah, both of those things.
I don't really think about that.
Yeah, I know. Nobody does. Nobody does.
Well, thank you for making me think about that.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, okay. Now you will. Now you will.
I'm just trying to keep my boy from growing.
Oh, I know. I know.
Have you seen him?
Yes.
He's monstrous.
I know. He's huge.
Yeah. Four generations of little Jews it took finally to break.
Then now he's... That's great.
But mothering is, I mean, it is completely gendered. It is completely based on sex and biology. Yeah. And I feel like that it diminishes that strength and that power mm-hmm. that is uniquely female.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of this book came out of my experience of that and just denying it, too. I was like, oh, forget it. Just make my own path, you know, whatever.
Mm, which everybody does.
Which everyone does.
And doesn't.
Which everyone does or doesn't. Yeah. I guess I was lucky. I mean, back to the idea of privilege. Like, I had enough room, enough education, enough good family mm-hmm. that cares for me to let that happen.
Well, I mean, think about like when you were having your first one.
Yeah.
I mean, you have all these
fantasies.
All these fantasies and all. Yeah. And, mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it's born and you're not prepared. I mean, I did not give birth, but yeah. I mean, as a father for the first time, I remember like the first 24 hours of, I was like, really?
You're in outer space. You've left the planet. You're like, how could this happen? This is the most bizarre thing ever. There's a person who wasn't here before and now this person's here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean...
And what do I do?
What, yeah. I mean, even like away from the idea of care, just the fact that it happens. I mean, it's astonishing and amazing every single time it happens. And how can we, how can we forget that? Or,
no, I
guess you have to forget it to some extent. But.
Well, you have the quotidian that you have to deal with it. You know, then there's the survival, you know, the basics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then thriving is a whole other level you got to sort of like worry about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just the same as how we forget the wonder of the world in any aspect, right? That, you know, you look at a pine tree and you're like, pine tree, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like, oh my God, how did that happen? You know? I hope that Mr. Splitfoot gets at some of that too, just like trying to make what's become familiar unfamiliar again to witness the wonder of everything. I mean, in that, so one of the narratives has these two women walking across the state.
Well, not just across the state. I'd like to say it's very specific to a time.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And even more specific to a place.
Yeah.
Which mm-hmm. is... the Erie Canal.
Yeah.
Is that a particular geography that attracted you for any reason? Or
yeah.
I mean, it's where... It's a remarkable and forgotten
mm-hmm.
region of New York.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, two major parts of the research of this book were focused around Troy, New York, where part of it is set,
mm-hmm.
which is a city that just totally captivates my imagination. I mean, it's so evident how... magnificent it once was and maybe how not magnificent it is anymore. Mm. Although, you know, these old buildings still exist that are so grand and glamorous and fantastic. And there it was right at the, you know, right at the junction of the Hudson and the Erie. It's at the intersection of New York State. And so starting from there, that was one point of research. And then the other point of research was down at the other end of the Erie Canal, like down by Palmyra, and all the religions in the burnt over district of New York that you know flared up in the 19th century, like Mormonism and spiritualism, and really just becoming very curious about, you know, how did all these religions start?
And why
did they all start?
Yeah.
And the idea of the American-ness of these religions, that was so attractive to me, and I thought, oh, all right. Well, I'm going to make my own religion, right? I'm just going to create my own thing here. And so the, you know, the way that I saw to link these two places was clearly the Erie Canal. I mean, they're a direct path between the two, right? And for a book that deals so much with death and dead people and ghosts, I was like, God, the Erie Canal is perfect. It's a dead waterway. It's not used for commerce anymore. Mm-hmm. And yet it's still flowing. I mean, it was really, really, really easy to turn the Erie Canal into like this River Styx, right? As this waterway that the dead can fluidly pass over. And I mean, come on, its name is Erie. I was like, yeah, it's Erie. And it's also just so beautiful.
There's a lot of great puns in there.
good.
Comet was one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you like that.
Yeah. I was like, oh.
But it hurts the nose. It hurts the nose.
There was a correlation between the existence of the Erie Canal and the Second Awakening, Second Great Awakening.
Sure.
I mean, that would not have happened without this just tremendous activity and the influx of people and commerce. And what is it about that area that sort of generated these religions? Do you mean as you were sort of researching and writing about it and thinking about it? And also, is it uniquely American, do you think? And the con as well. I mean, yeah. I like how you sort of move like religion and the
conmanship
sort of are weaved together, and it's hard to disentangle them sometimes, and you're like, well, does it even make a difference?
Yeah. Right. I mean, and the third thing I'd throw into that mix too is the fact that I'm a writer of fiction.
Mm.
And so, I mean, that sounds really nasty towards religion to call a lot of the religious leaders in the book con men.
Mm.
But I kind of do that with a sense of great respect too, because I myself am a practicing con man. I mean, I write fiction for a job. That doesn't mean I don't discount the con at all. I mean, fiction has changed my life. It changes everybody's life. You read a book and you're changed by it, you know?
Mm.
Even if it's made up of, quote, a bunch of lies, you know, it's like, it doesn't change the effect that it has on a physical body. It's like, and so when I was doing some of the research and going to the spiritualist camps and talking to people who channeled the dead.
Mm.
You know, I don't.
You go out to Lilydale?
Like, oh, yeah, I went out to Lilydale. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, that place is amazing. Amazing, creepy, and amazing.
Uh-huh.
I went to Lilydale and, you know, talked to some lady, got in touch with my dad, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. And he was sitting right down there next to me. And despite the fact that I didn't believe any of it, I'm still sobbing like a baby, you know. Because she's like, your dad's sitting next to you on the couch. And I thought, well, that's pretty intense. And then the other thing is, you know, a lot of the people who were there looking for their dead people were parents of dead children. And I have to say, like, that really resonated. I was like, yeah, what else are you going to do? You know, I thought, that's okay. I wouldn't be able to deal either. I would probably end up here. And I thought, that's an okay con. I'm fine with that con.
Mm.
I'm really fine with that. Mm. I mean, what is the difference between that kind of con and fiction? Or therapy. Thank you for saying it, Kevin. Yeah, and it's a lot cheaper than therapy.
It is.
When I went to all these mediums.
Well, because there's a sliding scale.
Yeah, it was like $60 when I would go to these mediums. And honestly, it was like 10 years worth of work, you know, therapeutic work to have a lady say, your dad's sitting next to you. What do you want to say to him?
I'm Yeah, you know. And I believe that they actually believe that to a certain extent.
Some of them, right?
I mean, the best, you know, the best cons believe their own con.
Yeah.
You know, I think.
Yeah.
And for you to talk to your dead father or your dead child, it's just you need to connect.
Yeah.
And the fact that it isn't there doesn't mean you're not making a connection.
No, it's true. It's true. But here's something I want to throw in the mix, too, is the idea of this sense of, like, increased wonder. And, I mean, part of the reason I had the women walking was so that they could move slowly enough so that they could notice every little thing, right?
Oh, I love that Cora loses her iPhone.
Yeah.
She loses her smartphone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets smarter when she loses it.
And almost immediately, yeah.
Yeah.
You do start noticing things.
Yeah, and she sees stuff.
She sees stuff.
And I mean,
and patterns. She notices patterns. I like, there's like every little town that they come into, there's a sort of a variation on a theme.
Yeah, she starts to like
and
get returned to an awareness that maybe we all have as kids. And so part of that questioning was it's not really to be lost. I mean, the whole concept in the book of like, it's impossible to be lost anymore. You can't be lost.
No.
I say that to my students all the time. I'm like, you guys don't even know what it means to be lost. And they're like, no, we don't.
No.
Like, that's amazing to me. I grew up lost all the time. I mean, actually lost. Actually lost and loved every minute of it,
right? Yeah.
You cannot be lost anymore.
There's a panic. But then there's, but then
there's a true American individualism that comes from being totally lost.
Being lost.
Not having a GPS, not being able to resort to, not being able to call somebody. Yeah.
Which leads us back to, like, how these religions maybe were founded, right?
Sure.
This true lostness of, like, I really, you know, there was the sun got eclipsed last night, and that probably means that God's really angry at us, so we are all going to die. Let's come together and believe this crazy stuff, you know? And I'm like, wow, that's really resourceful of you.
Because we're that important.
Because we matter that much.
Because I said this word and God made the sun go away.
Yep, exactly. Right. Here's one thing I want to throw in here, though, is like, we're talking about these con artists, right? And, you know, that it still affects you even if it's conjured in some way. But the other side of that is that weird stuff does happen all the time that we ignore or that is inconvenient to our sense of reality. And we just kind of act like, well, okay. Like, you know, moments of mental telepathy, things like this that we haven't explored enough yet, where everybody can say, like, well, you know, I was just thinking of you. That's so weird you would call. And we all know that happens all the time, and yet it's like we ignore it. I mean, and even freakier stuff, like a true, true ghost story where one of my daughters was 3 years old.
Mm.
She couldn't read at all yet at all. She didn't even know her letters yet, barely. And we drove past a roadside memorial where a young man had been killed, and it said Billy on it.
Mm.
And my older daughter said, "What's that?" And I was like, I didn't want to say because it was sad. And in the time that I stopped and paused, the three-year-old goes, "That's where William died." Not Billy. Not that she could read even. She said, "That's where William died." And I said, "How'd you know that?" And she said, "The robot in my head told me." So what am I supposed to do with that? What am I supposed to do with that? And I don't really tell people anymore because when I first started telling people, they'd be like, "Oh, well, obviously she had to blah, blah, blah. Someone must have, she must have read it in the newspaper." I'm like, there's your real magical thinking. A three-year-old who doesn't read read it in the newspaper.
Right,
I'm like, what are you talking about?
Or even
a
newspaper.
Exactly. A newspaper, yeah.
You know, that's fiction now.
I know. So I feel like weird things do happen that we also ignore. And here, I mean, I'm like setting myself up to be knocked down as like a crazy baddie female, I know, just by telling this story. But part of what annoys me is like everybody in the world has weird stuff happen and we act like because we can't explain it, we're not supposed to talk about it. Like what's wrong with just saying, "I can't explain it. It happened. It's crazy." I mean, it's also like, I can't explain eyeballs to you and I believe in eyeballs, you know? It's like, I don't know how eyeballs work, right? I don't know how fingerprints work.
Actually, I dated a woman who knows how
eyeballs work. Okay, you do know someone in the world knows how an eyeball works.
Neuro-ophthalmologists.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. But even then, they don't know how.
It's still pretty magic.
It is pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing that eyeballs can just be made in another person's body.
It's scary, it's dangerous. And especially now in this sort of technological age that we live in, there has to be answers, you know? And I think we really limit ourselves now. Because if we can't get an answer to it within, you know, immediately, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. And it's flighty and flaky and weird. And I think the thing that it puzzles me the most about that and the thing that's funny is like, people, we are all heading for the greatest mystery in the world. And that one's not solvable. And you're not going to solve it until it happens. And it's like, let's get comfortable existing with the fact that unexplainable, mysterious things happen, you know, and we can't know it all.
In Mr. Splitfoot, so many motifs going through it. And one of them is interesting, and is Linda Thompson. You tell a story about Linda Thompson losing her voice and her breakup of her marriage with Richard Thompson.
And she had lived in a cult, a Sufi cult.
And they too. Did they both?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, that she kind of said, like, well, you know, they needed the women because somebody had to cook.
Did you find that in the religions that you
researched? Yeah, well, I mean, the Mormons, for sure. I was looking at you know, straight up Mormons and also fundamentalist Mormons. But with both, I mean, women in the LDS church are not allowed to be priests, and all the men are priests.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you turn 18, if you have a penis, you get to be a priest. I was like,
is that right?
That's amazing. Yeah. And you get to, and you receive prophecy as soon as you're a man in the Mormon church. You are allowed to receive prophecy. So an 18-year-old young man could receive prophecy and tell his mom, actually, you know, God spoke to me last night, and I need you to buy me that pair of Nikes or what have you. And so, I mean, I would hope that it wouldn't be abused in that way, but yeah, you're,
I can't imagine how that could possibly be abused by an 18-year-old boy.
Yeah, yeah, right, I know. So there's that, you know, women in the Mormon church. Spiritualism is actually pretty female-centric, I'd say. I mean, especially in America, where the Fox sisters are both the founders and the, you know, they tried to recant everything they say and said it was all made up and it was lies.
Isn't that amazing that the founder, like, it's,
they were like, we made it up.
And they're like, Jesus goes, you know what? I just, the son of God.
Yeah. No.
No, not really.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, go on.
Yeah.
No.
You're just, sorry.
Not your son of God. Right.
It speaks to the power of belief and faith. It's like, wow. Right.
Well, but belief, I mean, it's faith. I mean, yeah. Facts are not important.
They don't matter. Yeah. No, they don't matter. No, if it helps you. I mean, I guess this goes back to our conversation about therapy and con artistry and fiction. It's like, if it helps you, who cares, right?
Yeah.
I guess people don't. Yeah. But Linda Thompson, okay. Oh my gosh, that woman. So I,
what is it that like resonated with you, or her story, or her music, or?
I mean, yeah, first of all, her music resonated with me. And then when I started to learn the story of how she lost her voice, she couldn't speak, couldn't sing. So she could sing a little bit, but she really couldn't speak after her marriage dissolved and the band broke up. And, you know, she raised...
For those of you who don't know, it would be...
With Richard and Linda Thompson. Yeah. And they had three children together. And I thought, oh, yeah, a lot of this is pretty intense for me, having three children and, like, just feeling that kind of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And then the loss of voice. It also resonated with me so hard because my great-great-grandmother, her first child died, and she lost her voice her entire life. Never got it back.
Really?
Never got it back, yeah. It's a condition called hysterical dysphonia where people lose their voice. Maya Angelou had it after she was molested as a child. She didn't speak for 2 or 3 years or something. Yeah. And
does it usually happen in women?
It happens in men also. Yeah. I don't know. That would be interesting to know what the gender split is on it.
Well, it's just because of hysterical.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my least favorite words in the world because that means uterus, you know, right? Ugh. So the idea of a woman without a voice, to me as a writer, was like the most amazing challenge. And I was like, how would I make a character who can't talk?
Mm.
And how do you create that? If you have a character who can't say anything, like, how are you going to make her in words, you know? And so I set that challenge for myself in the book to have a voiceless woman.
Mm.
And I mean, I kind of cheated.
I cheated. But I don't think that detracts from the mystery of it, you know? And I think actually it was because you knew this person from the time and the narrative that takes place earlier in this woman's life.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a sense of her. She then becomes a cipher for your thoughts and your feelings
as well,
which is what you need for fiction.
Yeah, and you then are on the walk with the women too, because you have like this empty space to walk in. And she also adds, I mean, the silence adds to that idea of slowing down and actually looking at the world, right?
Mm.
It's totally quiet on the road, and they're moving so slowly, they're moving so silently. It's like a rare, rare, rare moment to experience. I mean, it's something we don't get anymore. Let's move slowly and quietly through the world. I'm so tired of working every day.
so many different kinds of love in this this book.
Yeah.
And in English, we really only have like one word. You know, I know the Greeks had several words for love. They had two gods for, you know, different kinds of love.
Yeah.
And
There's a moment where one character said, Ruth says to her sister, "It's not like that between us." And even the fact that that's a phrase that we all understand what that means. She says that about her relationship with Nat. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like that between us. Because there's not another word for the kind of love that they have. It's like, what is that love?
Yeah. No, you have to modify it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
What is that? Like, they're, you know, young boy and girl who are not boyfriend and girlfriend. What is that? I mean, they call each other sisters, but yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, like, probably the most intense love here. That love.
Between sisters.
Yeah, well, between those two characters, I'd say. Between Nat and Ruth. I mean, there's, like, the love of this baby that's never appears in the book. Like,
right.
This unknown thing, this, like, little bit of outer space that's in one of the characters' bellies, right?
Right?
That is what it feels like when you're pregnant. You're like, there's outer space in there, because what's that? I don't know.
Is that what you felt like when you were...
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a great unknown. You're like, I'm carrying around this great unknown. I definitely loved my babies when they were in my tummy, but it wasn't like I didn't feel that I knew them. I mean, it's like loving the night sky. It's like, wow, that's amazing. How'd that happen? I mean, I know how it happened.
What makes a family, you know?
Yeah.
And there are no fathers, really.
No, which
either.
Is funny.
I mean, but there's, I mean, it's...
Because lots of people are called fathers.
It's a story.
Fathers,
a lot of people are called father, lord.
There's no fathers and no mothers in a book about family.
I was just thinking that. It was really...
That's funny. That's a good way to describe it, yeah. There's no mothers or fathers.
No technical mothers and no technical fathers.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess that was part of the question, like, you know, that revolves around who's taking care of the children. It's like when family fails, you know, what does happen to these kids? And so you get this group home of totally messed up kids that nobody's taking care of, you know. And I hope it didn't come across this way. Like, the guy who does end up taking care of him, the fundamentalist minister, he's like pretty, he can be two-dimensional at times, but there's one moment where he says, you know, the kind of snarky fella shows up who knows it all, and he thinks people who believe are stupid and blah, 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 right? And he says, yeah, Mr. Bell, and he says, you know, what are you doing? How many children have you fostered?
Yeah,
right?
No, I thought that was a real powerful point.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that's a lot that's pretty common to liberalism. It's like, yeah, dump on religion, but a lot of religions do actually try to help drug addicts, do actually try to help children in need,
Yeah, well, again, it speaks to the power of faith and fiction.
Yeah. I mean, my dad's life was saved by AA, and I always thought, you know, my dad didn't believe in anything, but he believed in AA, and it saved his life, you know, and I think that was the power of the church right there, you know. It's always churches that donate the space and whatnot. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very easy, I think, to bash religion, but that's not fair, totally.
No,
I mean,
until...
Don't get me wrong, I cannot be a part of it because I find it incredibly sexist, any organized religion, but then where are the places to take care of your fellow man?
So Linda Thompson was one of the inspirations of your book, and... you reached out to Linda
I tried to get in touch with her on Facebook, and I told her, I was like, you know, I have this book and you're in it, before it came out, and I said, and the publisher, you know, will happily send you a copy. So she sent me her address, and they sent off the book to her, and I, you know, waiting, I didn't hear anything, and I thought, okay, well, because she didn't care for it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So then just today, I'm not friends with her on Facebook because she has too many friends, you know, people who can't have any more friends on Facebook.
There's a limit?
Yeah, there's a limit. And then you have to have like a fan page instead if you're too popular.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I imagine that's more than 10.
I think it's a little more than 10.
Yeah, because I'm almost reaching 10.
You almost got to 10. Okay, all right.
I got like 7 more.
You're in the clear. You're in the clear. But so she, someone who is friends with her, sent this to my editor that she posted this today. It says, a writer called Samantha Hunt has written a book, part of which, she says, was inspired by thinking about how I couldn't sing, do gigs, that is, and how that must feel. It's hard, but struggling to speak is worse, so isolating. Luckily, I have good periods and bad ones. I have friends with dystonia who shake so violently and can barely make a sound, so I'm fortunate. I want to read that book, so if anyone knows of her or when the book is out, do please tell me. There's an upside to vocal dystonia. You don't quite talk so much rubbish.
Mm.
And then all of her friends...
It's out, Linda.
And then all of her friends really adorably, helpfully, like, said, oh, there's a link to her website. Here's a link to her book.
Oh, great.
I was like, I also mailed you one, but I'll mail you another, happily.
That's exciting.
I know.
That's
she's
great.
Amazing. I love her. I think she's amazing, so.
What about her music did you, do you remember when you first heard her? I mean, was it like an immediate thing?
Yeah.
Because there's a scene in the book, and I know you obviously draw on your life, your experience with, but there was a song comes on, and the person's like, stops what they're doing, listens on the radio. Mm-hmm. This is back when people listened to the radio and everything wasn't all, you had to like be patient and late and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And she writes down the name of the musician that was singing the song and then goes straight to a record store.
Yeah.
Right.
That was totally taken from my life. It wasn't a Linda Thompson song, but it was Bill Fox, who was way more obscure. Yeah. Joe ended up writing about Bill Fox. Yeah. But it was the first time I heard Bill Fox, and I was driving home from work, and I mean, you remember like when you'd hear something on the radio and if you didn't get the name at that moment,
it was gone. Yeah,
you never could find it.
Yeah.
You could spend years looking for a song that you had heard and not, you know, and I did with a lot of songs, just would spend years looking for it, which is like, I know it seems crazy.
It's wonderful, but that's the thing.
And then I went to a record store. They special ordered the Bill Fox CD. It took 2 weeks for it to get there. And then I drove 20 miles back to the record store to go pick it up. And then I had the CD and it just felt like total victory.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I had,
it's like rooting for the Mets.
Yeah.
You know,
like
when they finally win, the feeling is so much better, which is so different than rooting for the Yankees.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with the world today, you know, we're old people. You know, like, remember the world when it wasn't today.
Yeah.
And you had to live with that void.
Yeah.
You had to live with that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And you got comfortable with it. But then when finally that piece of the puzzle came in, and it fit. It was great triumph.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Because music, I mean, it made it more rare. It gave it a higher value. I mean, there's a lot of music in the book. There's all the stuff that was on the Golden Records.
The Golden Records.
Yeah,
I love that.
Voyager. Yeah.
For people who don't know, back, I guess.
In 77.
Mm-hmm. And there was a... Look, it's hard to look back at the 70s and think of it as a time of hope and optimism. But in some ways, it really was.
Yeah.
And it was neat reading about it in the book. And I'm like, yeah, no, I remember that. I remember.
Yeah.
And I remember if just because I was a little kid and it was like there was the excitement of the world. But yeah, we sent Voyager out to explore the stars. And,
yeah.
And we put LPs, right?
Mm-hmm. This is Golden Record.
With Earth sounds.
Yep.
You know, and it was music and
Chuck Berry's on there.
Chuck Berry.
Music from all around the world is on there. It's pretty amazing. I mean, and even just the sounds of, you know, a baby crying or whales. There's whale sounds on it, which are really spooky and wonderful. And yeah, it's an amazing collection.
You can get it online.
They made all the sounds available. Yeah.
And Carl Sagan.
And Carl Sagan put it together with Andrurian while they were falling in love.
Yeah. Cosmos.
Yeah. So I threw him in with part of my religion that I built. I was like,
part Mormon.
Sagan.
Part Cosmos. Carl Sagan. Yeah. Part queen.
Part queen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading the opening? This is from you created a religion in this book. Etherism. The book opens with a reading from the Book of Ether. Would you mind reading from the Book of Ether?
The epigram is written by a friend of mine. She's a Hardwick, Vermont poet. It's from her poem called Burying the Cat, and this is the last line of it. Once again, there are more dead things than ever before. Martha Zweig. That always struck me because I thought, yep, that's true.
It's always
true. And that's true, and it's true, and it's true. Okay, so here's a little reading from the Book of Ether. 1. We are approaching the greatest of mysteries. We float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. We know that this is impossible. 2. We the people, we believe all the words which thou hast spoken. We cannot understand the words. We fled all that day into the wilderness, even until it was dark. We commanded the rocks and the mountains to fall upon us, to hide us. We will rock you. 3. We crossed this great water in darkness. We lost a great number of our choice men. We will change them into cedars. We see there was no chance they should live forever. We will change them into cedars. 4. We have spoken, which is the end. We should call the name. We should call the name. We know that this is impossible.
And how'd you come up with that?
So that's all plagiarized from the Book of Mormon, mm-hmm. Carl Sagan's Cosmos, different rock and roll songs, the Constitution's in there. Yeah, there's a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. The Bible, there's some Bible in there. Yeah, and there's a few segments of the Book of Ether in the rest of the book, and yeah, it sticks true to those sources, I'd say. The Book of Mormon, the Bible, and Carl Sagan, and rock and roll.
How did you find common ground in there?
I mean, a lot of it was just jotting down lines that I loved, mm-hmm. and then listening just for where it echoed across pop culture, I guess, in music, you know, mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe they're talking about... I mean, the Book of Mormon itself is an amazing text.
Have you read the whole thing?
Not the whole thing. I went to the pageant upstate, Hill Cumorah, where they perform the whole thing. And, I mean, a lot of it is fighting. I had my daughter Rosa with me, and she's like, Mama, why is everybody fighting? And I was like, good question. That's the whole point. But reading the Book of Mormon is... A lot of it is amazing and beautiful when you think that Joseph Smith... is, you know, he put some stones in the bottom of a stovepipe hat and just started translating the Book of Mormon from the bottom of a dark hat. That's amazing to me. That's like, wow, that's crazier than I am. And I like that about it. And so, I mean, and he was taking a lot of it from, you know, the Old Testament, the New Testament. But I love it. I mean, those lines, like, we will change them into cedars. We know that this is impossible. That's poetry. I mean, that's so beautiful to me. And so I just tried to look for lines that really emphasize the poetry of that book and expand on that by putting them in some sort of conversation with other texts that interest me, like Freddie Mercury or, mm-hmm. you know, or the mm-hmm. Constitution, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking about the American documents.
Yeah, well, that's why I asked him, I mean, if this was a very American story.
Totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean,
Carl Sagan, huge American hero.
Yeah.
The effect of these American-born religions like spiritualism and mm-hmm. Mormonism. A lot of the problems, I don't want to say that they're specific to America, but we do them really well. I guess everybody's got the problem of kids not being taken care of and everyone's got problems with sexism, but... Yeah, this is our own brand of both of those problems kind of presented. And just, you know, honestly, just me being in love with the American landscape, too. I do love walking across New York State. Mm. I love New York State. I mean, a lot of the process of this book was discovering that and getting up into the Adirondacks a lot. And
It's vast.
It's huge.
I mean, it's a country. It could be a country.
It could be.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that was a shock to me, like after having lived in Vermont for 10 years, where the mountains there are a lot more knowable in some way. I guess because it's just smaller and more concentrated. But man, the Adirondacks in New York, there's a lot that just seems uncharted almost. And so that idea of getting lost there actually seems like a possibility. So that, yeah, there's that one scene where they're actually in the deep, deep woods and you feel like, ooh, they've gone off the edge of the earth, right? They're in the forest so deep that they are lost. They're truly lost in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of a book that Jackie Goss actually recommended. It's a YA book, but I loved it so much.
What?
It's called Catherwood.
Oh.
It's, and I'm sorry that I'm spacing on the author's name, but Jackie told me about it years ago, and it's the story of a young woman pre-Revolutionary War who settles in somewhere in upstate New York, and a woman of European descent, and she heads out with her baby one day to walk to her brother-in-law's house through the woods, and she gets lost, and she's lost for a year and a half. And it's like a true story of what lost had the possibility of meaning at one time. And that definitely captured my imagination in a huge way where I was like, wow, does that lost even exist anymore?
Yeah. You know, actually I interviewed Jean Craighead George.
Wait, that's really...
Side of the Mountain.
You interviewed her? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
She's still alive. No, she just died. She died about 2 years ago.
Oh.
I grew up with her. She she's one of my mom and dad's really good friends.
Really?
Yep. She's an amazing woman.
Oh, my gosh. She passed away.
She did. She lived a good long life. She was in her 80s, but
she was fantastic.
I always remember when I was probably like six or so that she came back from the Arctic once.
Yeah.
And she was telling a story about being up there. And, you know, it was like me eavesdropping on the adult conversation for sure, and they were all probably drunk a little bit. And she was saying that her pee would freeze before it hit the ground in, like, solid lines. And that image, oh, my God, I never left my head. I was like, oh, what? You know, she was an amazing, amazing woman. Yeah, she and my dad used to work together. They were colleagues.
When did you know that this is, like, writing is a life that you wanted?
I knew that I liked writing for a long, long time, but I remember getting out of college and I moved to LA for a very short time because I had free rent, and I was there and I was like, oh, this working stuff, I hate it. And I would get up. I did. Oh my God. I was so bad at it. I mean, I would try to waitress and I would just yell at people, and I would try to, you know, do retail, and I would just yell at people because it all seemed so stupid to me. I ended up being a waitress for years and years and years, like 10 years, but I was a really bad waitress. I was like your worst nightmare of a waitress because I just was so cranky at it. Those like 4 months in LA, I was like, I gotta get up early every morning and write. And I did. And that's how I wrote my first novel, just getting up really early in the morning while I was doing other jobs.
Mm-hmm. Virginia Woolf said, for a woman to write, needs a room of one's own and 500 pounds a year or something
That sounds like you might need a little bit more now, but about
Well, you know, it's
with
like
inflation.
Adjusted for inflation and, the exchange rate. Yeah. But
that's so true. I mean, and that's interesting too, to think about, like, that has been lost to some extent, being alone in your room. Like now you're not alone because you have your laptop. Well, I mean, I had to write this book.
Yeah, so what I was going to ask, where did you find a room of your own for this?
So when I was writing it initially in the draft, I could write it longhand in a book. So then I was okay.
Is that how you do it?
I started in a book. But once, by the time I started revising, which was only like, you know, like 5 years of it were revising, I had to do it on the computer. And so I would go into the car and I would drive down to the river and I would park at the river because there's no Wi-Fi there. So I wrote most of this book in my car.
So you got a thing, apparently, and I read the piece you wrote on fictional titles.
Oh yeah.
In books of fiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember and you mentioned Borges in it, and I loved that piece of Borges. It was just one fantastic creation after another.
Yeah.
But
he is Scheherazade for, I think, all of us, right? He's the originator of all the stories, I think.
Borges?
Yeah, he seems it to me. I mean, he really seems like Scheherazade. He seems like he came up with all the stories, and at least he came up with all the possibilities for all the stories, right? I mean, he wrote about the internet. You know, he saw this infinite library all those years ago and knew it was coming in some way. I mean, because he was, and because he was a librarian, and I thought, oh, wow, that's interesting that the librarian is prophet. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Huh. So what is it about?
Okay, so
fictional titles and books of fiction that gets you so jazzed or is it so interesting or exciting or
So my piece was about books that don't exist.
Yeah.
So all the books that I've written that don't exist, or all the books that other people have written that don't exist, because in all my books I hide titles of books that don't exist. And I mean, the article was about this strange thing that happened with this fellow who, he and I came up with the same fake author.
Right.
And then as soon as I realized
Wanda LaFontaine?
Wanda LaFontaine.
Yeah.
We both made her up.
But it's such a perfect name. It is such the name for like a supermarket checkout.
I know. And that's why, like, when I realized that we came up with, not only was she the same name, she was so clearly the same author.
So you both invented the same fictional person.
Invented the same fictional person. But then the creepiest part was that as soon as I kind of got onto it, I tried to get in touch with Lucius, the other author, and he died.
Oh no.
I know, and I felt like I'd killed him almost by noticing him. I really did for a long time. I know that's totally narcissistic of me to think that. It was so sad, though, to not have ever gotten in touch with him about the fact that we made the same fake author.
Do you have a writer or writers that are sort of your touchstone, or somebody you go back to, or somebody that just was like, this is what I want to get here.
Yeah. I feel that way very strongly about Haruki Murakami. He's somebody who I just adore and everything. Mm. And it's not that our writing is similar in any way, but he just is a huge inspiration to me because both he and Kelly Link, she's another kind of speculative fiction author, and both of them are very comfortable in presenting mysteries that don't get solved. Mm-hmm. And I think, all right. That to me is interesting, that idea of the unsolvable mystery, right?
But you kind of solve the mystery.
I do. I appreciate. but you're still existing with the same questions. It's not like I'm not trying to be a religion that tells you, hey, there's heaven and we're all going there. And,
no,
you know,
no, it's not the five people you meet in heaven.
No, it's not. Mercy. So the two of them, Murakami and Kelly Link, and then also Zabald, a German author, he writes about, he does a thing where his work really blends fiction and nonfiction in a way that, you know, he never declares which part is fiction and which part is nonfiction. Mm. And I appreciate that because that idea of fiction being discounted as some non-truth has always irked me. I'm like, what? You know, that's the highest truth ever.
A reader will accept certain fictional things. Mm-hmm. That are being pawned off as real and not others.
Yeah.
Like Absalom.
Yeah.
Right.
He was another person I was going to mention. Yeah. Yeah.
And
As I Lay Dying, his book As I Lay Dying was foundational.
Was it?
Yeah. Well, just how perfect a book can be. I mean, that book is like 163 pages, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it is perfect in every single way to me. It's like,
Faulkner, by the way.
We're talking about Faulkner.
William Faulkner, yes.
But yeah, As I Lay Dying, I had that in high school, sophomore year in high school.
Oh,
I have to say that I felt like
really
that maybe was part of the germ of like, oh my gosh.
Really?
I want to be a writer, yeah.
So this could be made into a film eventually.
Oh, Mr. Splitfoot?
Totally.
I thought you meant our interview, and I was like, what?
No, no.
Yeah, I'm no, hoping it will. There's like an agent working on it right now.
Is that
now.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I saw it. I see this is...
I could see it.
I could totally see this as a film, and I could totally see this as an actor's vehicle.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some great actors now.
Yep. I want Lily Taylor to be Ruth. When Lily she's Taylor. Silent Ruth.
Silent mm-hmm. Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anybody for Cora?
Mm. Not yet. Who did... Oh, my sister said Jennifer Lawrence from that character that she played in Winter's Bone. I thought that would be a good one.
Mm. And how about for Belle or...
Well, Belle, when I was creating him, this is not going to work for actual casting, but when I was creating him, I have to say, and this is going to maybe ruin the character for you, but I always thought of Captain Jack Sparrow, the Johnny Depp's character from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Really?
Which is totally wrong, because he's not that, but just because he speaks so funny, he has that weird way of talking, and he's got the skull rings on all of his fingers.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Were you thinking of him when you were writing him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It helped me to create some sort of character. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't have anybody for Nat yet in mind.
Yeah, Nat would be difficult.
He's hard.
Okay. Fantastic. Great book. I couldn't, like Gary Steingart said, I'm speechless. Right? I couldn't stop reading it. That's nice.
That is nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah, people have been saying some nice things.
And Kelly Link even has it.
Kelly Link. That was like...
Samantha Hunt's every sentence electrifies. Her new book contains everything that I want in a novel. If I could long distance mesmerize you, dear reader, into picking up this book and buying it and reading it at once, believe me, I would.
Yeah. Kelly Link.
Yeah.
Look at the bottom blurb. Look who that's from.
Oh.
Yes.
Yes.
Charlotte Bronte.
Charlotte Bronte even. I get the chills. Is it a true story? Is it a sad story? It's what people want. It has a lot of good energy in people. People will like it. It's intriguing because a person will know there's something two-sided. It's a good one.
That one I had to use a medium up in Albany to procure that one because...
You actually used a medium.
I did. Yep. I went to a medium in Albany to get Charlotte Bronte to talk to me. Sometimes I fear I need it.